Pain has reached epidemic proportions in America. I'm Dr. Paul Christo. This is Aches and Gains.
Dr. Paul Christo is one of America's leading experts on relieving pain. He's board certified, Harvard trained, and a pain medicine specialist at Johns Hopkins. U.S. News and World Report ranks him as a top doctor and among the top 1% in the nation for pain management. Older adults, children, and even infants struggle to cope with pain. But there's hope, and there are treatments that can ease pain and suffering. The show offers compelling stories about people who found relief. We share cutting-edge treatments from contributing experts, and we offer ways to help people cope with their pain.
Welcome to the show. Leukemia is a medical term for cancer of the blood cells. We're going to talk about acute myeloid leukemia, known as AML, the most common acute leukemia in adults. It arises from genetic mutations in precursor cells, known as myeloid cells, located in the bone marrow. These mutations interfere with the production of normal blood cells that help us clot, fight infection, or carry oxygen to tissues. Symptoms of leukemia can be nonspecific, but typically patients experience fatigue, weakness, bleeding, or infection. AML is rapidly lethal if untreated, but overall survival has improved for those under age 65 from just 8 months in the 1970s to 46 months in 2014. Although survival for those over 65 hasn't improved as substantially, precision oncology is helping to tailor treatments based on genetic and chromosomal testing. On today's show, we'll have the opportunity to hear from Dr. Mark Levis. He's a professor of oncology and director of the Acute Leukemia Service at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. He'll explain how and why AML develops, what puts us at risk, and then delve into standard treatments as well as novel therapies that are prolonging life.
Aches and Gains is supported by the Institute for Continued Healthcare Education, Daiichi Sankyo, and Kowa Pharmaceuticals.
Dr. Mark Levis is co-director of the Division of Hematologic Malignancies. He's an expert in acute myeloid leukemia and other leukemias, while his research centers on developing novel targeted therapies. Dr. Levis, welcome to Aches and Gains.
Thank you.
Tell us in everyday language what AML is.
AML, acute myeloid leukemia, is a cancer of the bone marrow. Mm-hmm. Now, everybody's seen a ham bone in the supermarket, hard, white on the outside, and this red stuff in the middle. That's the marrow. And the marrow is in every bone in your body. And one of the most important jobs of the marrow is to make the cells of your blood. And the blood cells floating around in the blood are red blood cells, which carry oxygen from your lungs to your tissues, white blood cells, many different kinds, and these are your immune system. And finally, these little things called platelets, which keep you from bleeding or help warm blood clots. And so all three of these cell types all come out of the bone marrow, and they're made by these things called bone marrow stem cells. And you think of that like a queen bee sits in your bone marrow and has children. The children start at the baby stage, the blast stage, we call them, spend a few days in the bone marrow growing up like larvae, and then amid great tears and sadness, they leave the bone marrow and go into the blood and die. They're about like a fruit fly. So the bone marrow stem cells live as long as you do and have to generate the cells of the blood for your life. And that's the bone marrow is the source, the factory where these blood cells are made.
Okay.
So AML, acute myeloid leukemia, one of your stem cells went bad and acquired mutations. And why did it acquire mutations? Well, sometimes people are born with a tendency to acquire mutations. They have a family history of cancer. Sometimes somebody was exposed to solvents. They work in a petroleum factory. They work with pesticides. We see this. They were exposed to radiation. Most commonly, though, we actually don't know why they got the mutation. They were on the planet long enough. And AML is a disease that the longer you're on the planet, the more likely you are to get. But anybody can get AML. And we're treating an 11-year-old right now, and I just treated an 89-year-old. And they can have genetically very similar disease. But the real important thing about AML is that there is not one AML. It is determined by the mutations that you find within the stem cell generating these cancer cells.
Mm-hmm.
So there are literally a dozen different kinds of AML determined by the mutation profile in them.
Well, Dr. Levis, how common then is AML?
Uncommon. There are 20,000 cases of AML every year in the U.S. versus about 1 million of the other kinds of the big cancers, breast, colon, prostate, lung, etc. Mm-hmm. You add up all those, you get about 1 million cases a year. Poor little old AML is 20,000 cases a year, so it's not common.
It seems like AML leads to a low percentage of cancer-related deaths, somewhere around 2%.
We cure about half of all AML patients right now, and that's rising quite a lot these days, or we keep them alive. Mm-hmm. So it's a pretty small percentage of cancer-related deaths.
It is. And when does it typically affect us?
The median age at this institution, Johns Hopkins, and when I say median, that's half of the patients are below and half of the patients are above this age, mm-hmm. is about 68.
Okay.
But the range is enormous. The longer you're on the planet, the more likely one of your little bone marrow stem cells is going to make a mistake in its genetic code and its program, and that will get it off to the races. And in fact, it takes typically about three or four, to result in this thing called AML. Well, 10% of the population at age 70 is walking around with the first mutation already. Chances are they will not get AML, but they're in the group that's enriched for those who will develop eventually AML. We are all of us born with the seeds of our own destruction. It's heart disease, some it's cancer. And we do see these cancer families where they say, oh yes, Uncle Eddie gets this cancer and Aunt so-and-so gets that cancer. We're getting closer at finding the genes that predispose those families to that cancer. Having that first gene often gives you a nudge in that direction, or that first mutant gene, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Even that means you might get cancer at the typical age people get cancer. 60 or 70, those are the seeds that you're born with. You can water them by smoking, by going and working in the petroleum plant. But they may grow anyway.
Now, Dr. Levis, let's take a deeper dive into factors that predispose us to developing AML. You mentioned a couple earlier.
Smoking, of course, that predisposes all people to all cancers.
Uh-huh.
Very, pretty slight, 1.5-fold risk, so just a slight increase in risk from smoking.
Mm-hmm.
The bigger ones are, again, working with solvents. And I'll see patients with AML who spent their careers working with, you know, pesticides or something like that. That certainly predisposes you to AML. But we don't have a lot more, you know, that really we can pin it down on. Most of the time, people who come in, they don't know why they got this, and we don't know either.
How about other chemicals, though, that might predispose us to AML?
Brake clean. This is a popular, boy, we would ask about brake clean. These mechanics will wash their hands with this. It's basically got all manner of solvents in it that are associated with the development of cancers. And while I'm sure brake clean, you know, on the label says, don't expose this to your skin, you know, use gloves or whatever. Well, I got news for you. The mechanics get that stuff all of themselves all the time.
Well,
I'm not casting aspersion on brake clean. I'm sure it's a very useful product. You have to use it properly.
Any other environmental factors that we should consider?
They've done studies on uranium mine workers, which is, you know, it's about as bad as you can get. You breathe in some uranium. That will give you lung cancer first, and if it doesn't give you lung cancer, the next thing it's going to give you is leukemia.
Wow.
So, you know, radiation exposure is one of the things that will give you leukemia. If you get to the blood, it'll get to a stem cell, and if you can get to a stem cell, it'll mutate the thing.
Mm-hmm. And how about chemotherapy?
When we give chemotherapy for breast cancer, we would then see the poor breast cancer patient come in with AML 2 years or 5 years later. And we said, aha, the chemotherapy did it. And there's no question that the chemotherapy contributes to it, mm-hmm. because we would see the same pattern of leukemia. But then I talked to you about the seeds of our own destruction.
Right.
And the patients who get cancer again. So how much the chemotherapy contributes is, I think, a bit more debatable. We used to definitively say yes.
Mm-hmm. And we've got to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk to Dr. Levis about whether we can inherit AML from our parents. I'm Dr. Paul Christo, and you're listening to Aches and Gains.
Aches and Gains is supported by the Institute for Continued Healthcare Education and by an educational grant from Daiichi Sankyo. To access podcasts of the show, please go to paulchristomd.com. That's paulchristomd.com.
Welcome back. We're here with Dr. Mark Levis. Mark is a professor of oncology and the director of the Adult Leukemia Service at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Mark, talk to us about whether AML in adults is associated with inherited genetic abnormalities? That is, can we inherit AML from our parents?
Well, only in, I would guess, about that we can find about 1 in 5, 1 in 6 people.
Mm-hmm.
Most patients, we cannot find a mutation that says this is why you have it.
Now, the genetics of AML can get pretty complicated. It seems that gene duplications, gene deletions are seen in the majority of cases. Are these genes that regulate the growth of the cancer cells?
Usually the pattern is, it's a threefold mutation. Mutation one is in something we call an epigenetic factor. That's a regulatory gene. It's quite complex. There's a whole field of study around it. If you mutate it, it doesn't cause an immediate problem.
Okay.
The next one is a what we call a transcription factor, a regulatory gene. And the third one is a growth factor mutation. And that's where you're off to the races and growing explosively. That third mutation is frequently a growth factor pathway mutation. So yes, you're correct, but it's the last mutation that's the growth stimulating one.
Mark, if someone has AML, how do they feel? I mean, it seems like a lot of patients feel fatigued, but this is a very nonspecific symptom.
Patients feeling tired for several weeks, had some recurrent fevers. They went to their primary care provider who gave them a Z-Pak. It didn't work. And then somebody finally got a complete blood count and freaked out and said, you have to go to the emergency room right now. And so patients feel totally fine up until 1 or 2 months before, most commonly with acute myeloid leukemia. That's why we call it acute. Happens fast.
You mentioned a CBC, a complete blood count. Now that typically shows anemia, that is a reduction in red blood cells. What else does it show?
Platelets are often dangerously low and the white blood cell count is either dangerously low or outrageously high, just wildly abnormal. So the ER docs generally know to look out for this sort of thing. Usually there is an infection. The leukemia itself can cause fever, but almost always there's an infection going on. You don't have a functional immune system anymore and you don't realize it.
Let me now ask you about how to diagnose acute myeloid leukemia.
What I do is I first look at the blood. It's our very first step. Mm-hmm. We talk to the patient. You get kind of this story of I'm fatigued. It's been building up for the last few weeks or whatever. Is it the right patient? We already know the CBC, so we know the blood counts are abnormal. I immediately want to go look at the blood to look at the white blood cells that are circulating in the blood.
Yeah.
And if there are immature cells, these baby blood cells from the bad stem cell go flooding out into the blood. Well, I can spot those and say, oh, look, that's a cell that shouldn't be out in the blood. That's a blast. And even some properties of it tell me what subtype of leukemia this is. That says you have AML, but I said there's 12 different kinds. Then the fun really begins. First, here at Johns Hopkins, we will do within hours a very quick test called flow cytometry on the blood to say, what kind of leukemia is this? Is this AML? Is this ALL? Is this, you know, CLL? What is this? We can usually tell it's going to be AML because it looks like it and it's the right patient. We confirm that. Then we have to do the molecular tests for all the mutations, and that's complicated. And those results can take days to weeks to come back for a final report.
What about the bone marrow, though, Mark? Because if you read about how to diagnose AML, it seems like almost universally the criteria indicate infiltration of the bone marrow by a certain percentage blasts.
Technically, when you go on to, you know, the various things online, they say you must have a bone marrow biopsy. Well, you don't need one if they've got a white blood cell count that's through the roof and there's blasts circulating everywhere. We don't bother with a bone marrow biopsy. That's actually, interestingly, not commonly known by general oncologists. They learn about AML and say, you've got a white blood cell count that's enormous and they seem to be all blasts. We have to wait for the bone marrow biopsy to die. No, you don't have to wait. You have the diagnosis right there. You can just do flow cytometry on the blood. But some blasts are, shall we say, shy. They don't want to leave the bone marrow safe and warm there, and they don't go floating around the blood. So you have to do a bone marrow to get the final diagnosis, to get a good sample of these blasts.
Well, then, do you need a certain percentage blasts in the blood or in the bone marrow in order to make the diagnosis?
Technically, the bone marrow has to have greater than 20% blasts, but seriously, wait, you're telling me 19.9% is not AML and 20% is?
Right.
So those are very vague terms. We pretty much say, are there blasts growing out of control here? It's more than 10 and it's clearly evolving AML, We just caught it a little bit early, I guess.
Now, once diagnosed, AML is categorized based on the World Health Organization system. There are about five categories. Can you distill those down for us and make them understandable?
The categories are almost irrelevant from WHO. It's what mutations are present. WHO is kind of 5 or 10 years behind all this because the world does not have access to the kind of medicines we honestly have here in the U.S. We categorize them based on what mutations are present that are going to determine what we're going to give the patient and what patient I'm treating. Is this an 85-year-old with dementia in a wheelchair from a nursing home, or is this a 22-year-old Olympic athlete, or is it a 50-year-old homemaker, a 60-year-old about to retire geometry teacher, and how fit are they? It's all personalized to the patient and the mutations within the disease.
Well, indeed it is. Now, what other hematologic cancers, that is blood cancers, can mimic AML?
There's a condition that often gets mistaken. It's called ITP, immune thrombocytopenia. It's an autoimmune disease. It's seen often in younger patients. The platelets are low. And that can be the first sign of AML. Any abnormality of the CBC, you want to have a referral to a hematologist to make sure what you're dealing with here.
Right. And Dr. Levis, how do you discuss treatment with patients with respect to remission or cure?
A conversation I had with a patient 2 weeks ago, when the patient comes in, they're sick. You know, we're trying to find out what kind of AML they have and why they're sick. We get all that stabilized. And then we find the preliminary genetics. And this is one of those 1 in 5 AMLs that we do not see cured. And so I have to use the word terminal. And my goal of care is to put it in a semblance of remission, control the disease, get you out of the hospital feeling well, but you're on the clock. And that clock is probably around a year. Wow. That's sort of a worst case scenario. And that's about 1 in 5 patients.
What about the other 80%?
That's really the majority of patients where we have a fighting shot at cure or a very good chance at cure. And I tell the patient, I will ruin 6 months of your life because you're going to be in and out of treatment for 6 months before I can get this definitively dealt with.
With respect to remission versus cure, will you help us understand the difference?
Remission means I've cleared out the blast. Those are the children of the bad stem cell. I have not killed off the stem cell. They're tough to kill. And so that takes me many more months or I don't always succeed. So remission is not cure. Remission just means we can't see the leukemia, at least by conventional techniques.
All right, that's a great explanation. And then Mark, is complete remission possible most of the time?
Most of the time we are, and that really includes patients in their 80s. We're going for remission. And we can get it frequently. I took one look at this 81-year-old's disease and I said, oh, I think I can get this in remission. And I've got the patient on a targeted therapy to keep it there. We actually don't know how long it goes because we really kind of developed most of these drugs just in the last 5 to 10 years. So we don't know if they last for 10 or 20. We know they last 5.
Well, also an important part of diagnosis are the cytogenetics. And we'll talk about that right after the break. I'm Dr. Paul Christo. And you're listening to Aches and Gains.
Aches and Gains is supported by an educational grant from COA Pharmaceuticals America, Incorporated. For cutting-edge treatments and resources, follow Dr. Paul Christo on Twitter at Dr. Paul Christo and like Aches and Gains with Dr. Paul Christo on Facebook.
Welcome back. We're speaking to Dr. Mark Levis about acute myeloid leukemia. Mark, before we get into some of the exciting treatment developments, let's backtrack a bit and talk about the details of testing, specifically cytogenetic testing. Do all patients with AML need this?
What's cytogenetics? It's your chromosomes. We're all born with 23 chromosomes from mom and 23 from dad. And what leukemia cells will do, and cancer cells in general, they have great fun with this. They will take a chunk of chromosome 8 and stick it on to chromosome 21, thereby making a brand new gene. And those are called translocations or cytogenetic abnormalities. There are several other layers of tests looking at single mutations in the DNA coding that would not be seen in the cytogenetic analysis. And that's really what's changed things in the field. Is it's called next generation sequencing, where we will literally sequence entire, you know, all of the what we call hotspot areas that a leukemia cell might try to mutate. There's about 60 or somewhere probably between 60 and 100 of them. And we'll screen all of them to see if we see any of these mutations.
And then do you base treatment on the cytogenetic abnormalities or the abnormalities in the karyotype?
They do for some. As I say, about 40%, 50% of AML has got a finding on the karyotype that dictates treatment, but the other half doesn't. And that's where, you know, you use the other methods of detecting mutation to determine treatment.
Okay. The genetic analysis then is required to diagnose and classify AML and to identify therapeutic targets. Is that right?
Correct. That is exactly right.
Now, let's delve into genetic mutations, specific genetic mutations. And the one I'd like to talk about is called FLT3. That's FLT3. This is among the most frequent genetic alterations in AML.
The FLT3 is a receptor. It sits on the cell, and its job is when the body says, I need more blood or I need more cells, it will produce a chemical called a cytokine, FLT3 ligand, a little chemical that will float up, bind to the FLT3 receptor on the surface of the cell. The FLT3 then transmits that signal inside the cell that says, apparently we need more of us. It's a growth factor receptor. And so leukemia cells said, what a great idea. Let's just turn that thing permanently on. So that's FLT3.
And where are these receptors located? In all cells?
FLT3 is not found in most of your cells. It's only found in those little stem-like cells in the bone marrow.
Mm-hmm.
When a FLT3 mutation occurs in one of those cells, it just grows like mad, and its children don't grow up. And so they still express the FLT3. So a normal blood stem cell has FLT3, and then when it's has, you know, it divides and has progeny, the progeny mature into a mature white blood cell, there's no FLT3 on that. So a mature cell is never supposed to have FLT3 on it, but the leukemia cells do, because they're basically baby cells.
And how frequent are the mutations of the FLT3 gene?
It's the single most common mutated gene in AML. It's about, you know, a quarter to a third of AML patients are going to have a FLT3 mutation in their leukemia.
Wow.
So having an inhibitor has been a big deal in changing the outcomes for those patients.
Now, chemotherapy alone then doesn't seem sufficient treatment for patients who have a FLT3 mutation.
If you give chemotherapy alone to a patient whose leukemia has a FLT3 mutation, the good chance the chemo won't control it for very long and the patient won't get in remission.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the way chemo works is it basically damages DNA, and leukemia cells are dividing very rapidly, and they're vulnerable to this. Chemo is really kind of like napalm. It just burns everything, and then you hope the grass grows back rather than the weeds, which would be the leukemia. Well, with a FLT3 mutation, that's what grows back quickly, quicker than the grass. So the leukemia might go down a little bit and then grow back quickly. But FLT3 is an enzyme, and it's kind of like a motor driving the cell to divide. And we can quickly design drugs that stick in the mouth of this enzyme and shut it off like a light switch.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you give chemotherapy with a little pill that's a FLT3 inhibitor, all of a sudden the patient's very likely to get into remission. It can't grow. That doesn't kill the stem cell with the FLT3 mutation, but we can get the patient in remission. We can kill off all the children of the bad stem cell. The healthy stem cells can make blood, fill up the bone marrow, and that's a remission. The next step then is, how do you kill off that bone marrow stem cell with that mutation? It's going to try and regrow.
Right.
Now, you can either keep them on the FLT3 inhibitor, the pill, for the rest of their life, but cancer cells have sneaky ways of getting around a single thing. And so what we usually pull out in that instance is a stem cell transplant, a bone marrow transplant.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, because in part two of the show, we're going to discuss treatments for AML that start with induction therapy, progress to consolidation therapy, and then maintenance therapy. And beyond that, we're going to delve into the details of precision therapies or targeted therapies like a FLT3 inhibitor, quizartinib, as well as midostaurin. Dr. Levis, it was tremendous having you on the show today. Great information. Thank you.
Of course.
And I'm Dr. Paul Christo, and you're listening to Aches and Gains.
The views and opinions expressed in this radio program are solely the views of Dr. Paul Christo and do not necessarily express the views of this radio station and Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, nor an endorsement by any or all of them of any of its content. This show provides medical information, not advice. Please consult your personal physician before engaging in any course of treatment or use of any of the techniques or products discussed on this show. Discussion of particular uses of products on this show have not been approved by any of the manufacturers of such products. To access podcasts of the show, please go to paulchristomd.com. That's paulchristomd.com. Aches and Gains is produced by Ty Ford. Dr. Paul Christo is the executive producer. Thanks for listening. This is Aches and Gains with Dr. Paul Christo.